Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Du lytter til Rytter Jargon podcast. Mit navn er Mads Wirt Schmidt, og jeg er professionel cykelrytter. I min podcast Rytter Jargon snakker jeg med andre professionelle cykelryttere, hvor der er fokus på de gode historier, som vi oplever på vores vej. Jeg inviterer både danske ryttere og udenlandske ryttere ind i mit lille hjemmestudie og prøver så vidt muligt også at have mit grej med ud til de løb, jeg kører. I denne episode har jeg haft besøg af australier Nathan Haas, som kører for Cofidis. Vi kørte sammen i 2 år på Team Katusha og blev hurtigt gode kammerater dengang. Så vil jeg lige nævne, at jeg arbejder på at få en lækker jingle op at køre, så hvis man sidder derude med noget fedt, feel free til at smide mig en besked på min Instagram-side, som også hedder Rytter Jargon. Derudover vil det betyde rigtig meget, hvis man lige smider en anmeldelse og giver nogle stjerner der, hvor du hører podcasten. Nu hvor jeg har haft besøg af Nathan, er denne episode selvfølgelig på engelsk. Jeg har ikke meget mere at tilføje lige nu, så jeg vil bare sætte samtalen i gang. Nathan Haas, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I think you know how I am, man. We just...
We did a good ride today. It was chaos.
Yeah, I think right now we're both pretending to be more alive than we are, but here we go. We're here for a podcast.
Yeah. Like, just to talk about the training, we set out to do some climbing. We both had some long efforts. I had to do 3 times 25 minutes at 5 watts per kilo. And I started puncturing.
Yeah, Matt's got a puncture on the first climb, like 15 minutes. He just caught me on the climb because I started a bit earlier than you. And yeah. I was like, shit, Matt is catching me, shit. And then he catches me and he goes, hey, dude, I'm getting a flat. I was like, okay, cool. That's good for my confidence. And then things were all good. We got to the top of the second climb. And then on the
second effort,
the downhill, Mads is like,
you
ripped
it there in the end of that effort, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. So my efforts were like 24 minutes at 5 watts per kilo. And then the last minute was just to go to like infinity. So it's kind of a confidence boost when you finish fast. I was like, yeah, that must have been a good one. That must have been good. But yeah, and then Mads flatted a second time and he's like, man, do you have a tube? I pull out my tube and he's like, yeah, so I got some pretty deep wheels here.
Yeah, I need a long valve.
So we were stuck on the side of the road and I was going to do this sort of old mountain bike trick where you actually cut the tire in half, or the tube in half, and then you just tie a knot in it and it normally gets you home. But then we found out that the actual wheel itself, like the valve,
the tape from the rim inside, that's what gave me the punctures.
Yeah, so there was nothing we could do, and then we started pulling out like tape of our bar tape, yeah. Seeing if we could like do like a dodgy taping job, and then we realized straight away it was just not going to work. So we rode Mads up a bit of a hill and we planted at a cafe. And his partner was doing Pilates.
I was going to call her to come get me, and just as we sat down, it was 2 o'clock, and there she had her first Pilates class she just signed up for. So, yeah, I had to wait for that to be done. So we sat there for an hour, waiting for her to be done so she could come pick me up, which would also be an extra hour sitting there. But then after 1 hour, suddenly some Danish guys came by. Beacon Christensen, he's an old pro, actually. Yeah, he's a triathlete.
Man, I was going to say, those guys look so ripped. Yeah. It's like, man, that guy's wearing aero booties on a training ride. These guys are for real.
He's actually a triathlete now, but he did the tour once, and he was also top 20 in Switzerland, in Tour of Switzerland. So
wow.
He had a good few years. And he had big wheels like I have, and he had an inner tube with a long valve. Yes. So we did some more bar tape, put it inside, and I could get to the service course of my team. They could fix it up properly, and I could keep on training. But it was a long day.
Oh, yeah. I'm feeling how long we just were out in the sun, and your sun burnt to a crisp.
Yeah. I have a shop down line now.
I think you're going to have trouble sleeping tonight. You're going to be sweaty.
Maybe. So, Nathan, you're on my podcast called, in Danish, called Rytter Jargon. And which is
hang on,
like,
I'll try say it. Rydde Jargon.
Rydde Jargon.
Rydde Jargon.
Yeah. So it's like,
I think you could translate it into like cycling lingo, which is this like talk we have when we are on the bike, when we sit on the bus before races and everything. And I ask all my guests to bring some lingo to the podcast. So what do you have?
Yeah, I heard this great Danish expression once in riding. It's like little peck. No, I actually do know what that means. So sorry if this is not an X-rated podcast. I should probably keep it clean. But years ago when we were in Australia for a Tour Down Under, Mads, we were sharing like a data box for Wi-Fi, and Mads was like, yeah, the password is little peck.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, cool. And after days, I was like, so Mads, what does little peck mean? He's like, yeah, it means a little dick. Yeah. It's like, ah, cool.
No one would guess that around Australia.
No, I don't think so, man. Yeah. I don't think so. Danes haven't really migrated so much to Australia.
Yeah.
No, but I think if I was going to have any jargon, I don't know if the word actually exists in America or England, but it's definitely an Australian word. Is
even better.
The sniveler.
Sniveler.
The sniveler. Do you know what the sniveler means?
No.
So the sniveler is that guy that we all know in cycling. Everyone knows one. It's the guy that when you get into a breakaway or you're like chopping off or you're training, that just sits on or does way less than everyone else. And they're like always hiding in the wind. And It's not just because they're like suffering. You know, it's totally cool if you've got a passenger and they're suffering and you're like, oh yeah, you know, that guy's doing his best. It's the guy that even on a training ride always just has to have that character about them that's just like, always have to snivel. Like, I just have to snivel.
He's sit on the wheel and then he wait until the final sprint.
Yeah, it's like the Gollum of bike riding.
Or the last 2 minutes of a swapping off and then he puts the hammer down.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, thanks, sniveler. And then they win and it's like that sort of like, you just imagine that they put their arms up like Chris Horner when he won that stage in the Vuelta. He just looks like a broken hawk and you're just like, yeah, you won, but you're a sniveler.
Yeah, okay. That's a good one. Good to know. So let's get into it. Your favorite training loop. Don't say the coast here. Everybody says the coast.
So I'm going to go with the coast in the Costa Brava. You know, I won't say it's like the most beautiful bike ride, but it's the one that I kind of grew up on. It's like been my bread and butter. And it's every time I go back to Australia, it just reminds me of how I actually became a good bike rider because it just inspired me to love jamming super hard. So I grew up in a town called Canberra, which is the capital of Australia. Most people think it's Sydney, but it's actually Canberra. And it's an amazing cycling community. So like, you know, a few years ago, we had a pretty good representation in the World Tour. We had Michael Rogers, we had Matt Heyman, Rory Sutherland, Michael Matthews, myself. So there were 5 World Tour. Now there's Jay Vine as well. He's from Canberra. So we have this Saturday morning bunch and it leaves at 6:30 from the bike shed in Phillip.
Yeah.
So I doubt there's any Australian.
That's what people do in Australia. They go out super early cause it's so fucking warm.
Yeah. And it's also cause like a lot of guys that, you know, race the criteriums or the club races, like, cause they're so, so motivated. They go out and do the bunch rides before work. So like before they start the 8:30 job, they get up for the 6 a.m. during the week. And Saturday they get a bit of an extra sleep in because it starts at 6:30. So we start off and we immediately just start jamming on the front. And the first turn, it's just like whoever's doing it, they're doing like 550 watts. It's just like full gas from the start. So like you want to have definitely swallowed your breakfast by then. And I think I've seen a few guys, you know, chuck a little bit up in that first part. But it's just literally it's full gas. And sometimes it can be like 150, even 200 people start. But the good riders will be about 40 of us. We sort of sit at the front turning and everyone else at the back is just hoping to hold on for as long as they can. And it's quite a cool ride in that we actually go past all of the different embassies. We actually go past the Danish embassy. We go down the main avenue, which kind of goes through the guts of Canberra. And we actually pass Parliament House.
How is the area there? Is it hilly or is it mountains or is it just flat?
So Canberra is actually I wouldn't call
it's
it...
It's underwater, no? Is that close to the water?
No. So we're actually 2 hours inland from the ocean. It's sort of like strategic that all national capitals tend to not want to be on the coastline. It's safer if they were to be bombed in wartime. But that's a bit old school. But the Canberra is actually inside a big valley. So if you want to climb in Canberra, there's more of it than you can poke a stick at. But through the middle of Canberra, it's actually perfectly flat. So like the first part of the ride is just this like flat launch all the way past Parliament House. You go over Commonwealth Bridge on the lake. So you're going past like the National Library, you're going past the High Court of Australia. And it's actually quite a beautiful way to start the day because like all the rowers are out on the water and the sun is sort of like off and rising as we're going. So it's very beautiful. But the thing that I love about it is just pure bike riding. Everyone is swapping off literally as hard as they can. And we do an hour of swapping off until we get to the first sprint point. Mm. And then the first sprint point, it's like a set line that we all know. And it turns into a race. Like some guys launch off early and there'll be like 2-3 guys swapping off. And then the bunch has to get it. And of course you always have a couple of snivellers that are just like waiting for the sprint.
Yeah, yeah.
I've played all the tactics, but I always try to like light it up early to just make it as hard as possible. And then there's this like huge 500 meter straight that everyone does a bunch sprint for. And like, it's open road. So like you do have to be careful for cars, but you know how it goes. Some guys tend to take a bit more risk than you want to. And like
a group of 100 people all sprinting for the same line.
Yeah. By then it's whittled down.
Yeah. Of course.
It's whittled down a lot. But then the cool thing is, after the sprint, we actually kind of wait for everyone. So we go super slow for another 5K. We just sort of like catch our breath, drink a bit, talk some shit. And then the race starts again. So we hit onto this like next part of the road called the GDE. It's like the Gungahlin Drive Extension. And now we actually start going up some undulation. So it's like 1 to 2K at like 5-6%. And then you've got like these big fast dips.
Yeah.
And that goes for another 30 minutes or 25 minutes that goes for, and then we turn right and we actually finish on top of a climb. So it's like a 2K climb at 8%. Mm. And it's just an absolute all out smash fest to the top.
That's a 5 minute all out.
All out. And it's sometimes it's actually been my biggest 5 minutes for the year.
Yeah.
Like I often hit my records on it because it's just pure racing.
Yeah.
And like generally speaking, everyone's pretty honest, but yeah, again, you always get the one or two snivellers that have just waited because they're a climber, you know, they don't want to waste their energy on the flat. But yeah, you get to the top and it's just like, it's all ones and twos at this point. You know, everyone's absolutely waxed. But then again, we all kind of wait. So like anyone that was dropped on the first big pull-off section, they actually don't do that extra extension. They go straight into the city. And we all join up at the same cafe. So like everyone kind of arrives in drips and drabs, but more or less at the same time. And then the first coffee happens and there's...
Oh, you have a coffee stop there.
Yeah. And there can be like 100 of us all at the same cafe. Oh. And like they all know that
we're... Good for the cafe.
Oh man, they love it. They've got 100 dudes all ordering heaps of flat whites and banana bread. And
yeah,
it's honestly, it's just that real feeling of like community. It's like a cycling tribe. Everyone's just so stoked. They're talking about what happened on the ride. They're laughing at a couple of guys. And like a lot of the girls, like Gracie Elvin as well, she gets super amongst it. And it's like, it's just a really big community thing. And, you know, it's just a great cycling world in Canberra.
So then you're at your coffee stop. So what's your menu there? Like your Australian menu? Because in Spain, you would go for the bock, like everyone with the tortilla and then coffee here. But what's your coffee stop in Australia?
So like I'm going to make a big call here, and maybe Denmark, I've heard the coffee's pretty good, but I'm going to say it, that the coffee is the best in the world in Australia. We invented the flat white. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, no one does latte art like in Australia. So, you know, it's a bit of a funny one because we arrive at the cafe at like 8:30. So we've done 2 hours of riding, and like a lot of us actually go and do extra kilometers afterwards. So it's not like we want to sit down and have a big breakfast, but some people do. So it's like, you know, poached eggs, salmon, avocado on toast.
Yeah.
And the only shit thing in Australia is like avocado on toast can be like $17. So, you know, you want to...
Yeah, yeah.
You want to...
Sounds like Danish prices.
Yeah, it's super shit. It's not like being in Spain or France. It's just expensive. But
when you have an avocado toast here in those fancy cafes and it's like 5-6 euros, you're like, ooh,
damn, should I have two?
That's expensive here.
It's easy to be skinny in Australia because you just can't afford to get fat. But I think, you know, for the most of us, like the real classic in Australia is the banana bread.
Yeah.
So it's like a big, big fat cut of banana bread. It's heated up, comes with a nice fat chunk of butter, and it just, oh, it melts in perfect. So
nice.
When you have that with your one or two flat white coffees as sort of like a mid-ride break,
yeah.
I'd say that's my most Australian memory of food as a bike rider.
And yeah, and so the group ride ends at the cafe or you keep going?
for a lot of people, it ends at the cafe
because
they just come for the vibes as much as anything. You know, everyone gets a good workout, but it's really the vibe of it. But then there'll be that 20 guys that really take their game seriously that are because a lot of guys are training for the Australian National Championships. And like one of the funny things about nationals is that anyone can enter. Like as long as you've got a bike license, you can start. So sometimes we have 250 guys starting the nationals, and it's like the most dangerous part of your year is the first few laps of that because
you're kind of
like navigating through guys that probably aren't fit enough to even do, you know, 4 or 5 laps. But they spend their whole summer training for it. So there's like a massive group in Canberra that are all training for nationals, and a lot of them are really good. Like they'll be in all part of the different continental teams in Australia that race through Asia. So they're normally pretty fit at this time of year. So they'll be normally on Saturdays, it turns into a 6-hour ride where we go and do this other loop called the Yuriara Cotta. So yeah, by the time you get home, it's 12:30, 1, and you've done 6 hours over 200 Ks. Yeah. And yeah, then you just hopped it back to bed because you were just dead.
Yeah. So there you have it. If you ever find yourself in Canberra, you can go try smash some Stravas.
That's it, man. Anyone's welcome.
Possibly going to be impossible to do it.
All inclusive.
Cool. Moving on. What is your craziest day ever on a bike?
Oh, this is my 10th year in the world tour. And I did quite a few years mountain biking, World Cups, and then quite a few years continental on the road. So I've been doing it for a while. And when I get asked this question, it just like, I can't think of any other day except for the Gavia Stelvio stage in 2014 at the Giro, where
the one Thomas De Gendt, he rode everyone behind, like out of the wheel.
No, it wasn't that day. It was the day that Quintana flicked Rigoberto Urán for the pink jersey, where we started in this town. I'm really bad with Italian town names in the Giro because once you've done the Giro enough times, it just feels like everything is San Marco. Or
when you do a Grand Tour, when you're 1 week into the Grand Tour, you don't even realize where you are.
No, you're just looking at that book and you're like, all right, we're getting through the pages.
Yeah.
We're getting through it.
Oh, shit, today's Gavia and Stelvio.
So we had just had the second rest day, which everyone knows can be like 50-50. You can come out of it feeling fantastic because you actually got rest, or you can be like, this is going to be the worst day of my damn life.
Yeah.
So, you know, you were sitting on the start line, nervous about that anyway. Fortunately, I'd actually been having really good legs that Giro and was climbing well. So I was more on the slightly confident side. But when we started, it was actually snowing in the village where we were, and we were at 1,000 meters. The snow wasn't like gathering, but it was snowing, and we were like, if it's snowing here,
going to 2,500 meters.
I think the top of Stelvio is 2,900.
Yeah, it's close 2,700, 2,800.
Yeah,
something.
It's super high. So we knew that we were going up the Gavia first, and then the Stelvio, and then we finished on another. It wasn't Lago di Cancano, but it was close to Cancano, and We just were all like, this is super shit. Like, oh my God, I can't believe we're starting. Like, oh, what is going on? And the organizers were like, if it's really bad at the top of the Gavia, like, everyone can maybe hop in buses. We'll see what we can do, but we're going to start. And then all of the riders kind of made like a pact, and they were like, we just don't attack. Nothing happens here. And then we got 2Ks into the race, and then a Katusha rider.
I was going to say Bariani.
So it was Bariani and Katusha hit off the front, and then it was like, shit, the truce is over. Like, you know, we can't just let them fly up the race. So then the race went absolutely batshit crazy. And then I was super lucky that I was on a really good day. So I got over the top with the front group of about 30 guys. So when you can go hard in the cold, you stay warm. So at that point, I was at least like, all right, this is okay.
But you still have 22 kilometers of downhill from the Gavia.
And that was the problem. Yeah. So we started going down the Gavia, and like, I was a little bit dropped because I was trying to put on so many jackets because I was like, I've only got one option. And then I finally kind of got back to the tail end of the group, and I saw this like weird red light in the distance. I was like, oh, what's that? I can't really make it out because there was just so much snow falling, and it was also foggy at the same time. The visibility was like 10, 15 meters at the most. So I was going down, and then I was like, I might just move to the right here. And one of the race cars had kind of like hit a snow wall and was just parked into the side. If I hadn't moved, I would have gone smack bang into the back of this car. And then my glasses were getting so covered in ice that I couldn't see through them. So I had to take them off, and I had nowhere to put them. So I just threw them. I was like, fuck, I'm in crisis mode here. And then my eyes were in so much pain because the snow was just going directly into them.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the worst thing in my life. So I make
it down. You're Australian. Probably the first time you ever saw snow.
I was like, what is this incredibly hard water? This rain is very strange.
I remember a few years back, we were traveling together to Stadio Bianchi. And it was snowing when we landed in Pisa. And you were like, oh, you're doing videos of the snow from the car and everything. I'm like... Dude, you've never seen snow before. No, this is maybe my fifth time.
This is amazing. Yeah, so I started and we started on the Stelvio, and then the problem was like you hit the bottom of a climb like directly after such a long descent that my legs just turned to shit.
Yeah, you go straight into Bormio and straight onto the climb there.
So then there was like the group of 30 and there was like two of us that dagged off the back, and I'm like, all right, well, I'm okay because there's like 180 guys behind me. Like, yeah. I will find groups. So the first 10 minutes were pretty tough on my legs. And then I was like, there's no group. So I just sort of like cracked on. And then I was really lucky that one of my directors, Robbie Hunter, came up next to me on the car. And I was like shivering going up the climb wearing every jacket I had. And I couldn't get to my food. And he's just leant out of the window and he's just opening gels and just like milking them into my mouth. And he pumped about 5 or 6 gels into my mouth. And I was just trying to swallow it. It was like pretty intense because your body doesn't want to eat at that point.
Yeah.
Like you're just so past being okay. But like, I'm glad he did because I think if I hadn't eaten, it would have just been like game over, right?
Yeah.
So I've gone over the Stelvio again, fully alone. I'm like, what has happened behind? Like, this is insane. And then I take that next descent just super slow. Like I was just breaking through every corner and then braking on the downhill so I could pedal harder. Like it might sound stupid, but I was like, if I can pedal, I can stay warmer. And I don't care about time. Like, obviously, the race is...
Yeah,
like,
you're safe for the time limit. And fuck, imagine being in that gruppetto that day.
So anyway, like, the gruppetto was the biggest thing I've ever seen in my life. It was like, I knew that they weren't going to cut the gruppetto even if we were an hour out of time because it was the whole bike race.
Yeah.
But what I didn't actually know was, like, in front, like, on my radio, I sort of heard some sort of shit talk. I was like, and it was going on for way too long. I was like, what is going on up there? And it actually turned out that the RCS had gone in front of the race with a scooter with a red flag saying that the race is neutralized. But Quintana attacked at the top for the downhill, and Hegedal followed. And then the whole controversy was like, you know, was the race actually neutralized or wasn't it? And then that was where all the big time splits happened. But I finished up the last climb and it was like, it was probably one of the most empty feelings on a bike I've ever had, just in terms of my legs. Like my body was almost in shock from what had just happened, but I'd gotten through the day a lot easier than most. And I'd actually found out that more or less what happened even on the Gavia was that every single car just told the riders, guys, just hold on. And there's photos of like 10, 12 riders on one team car just being pulled up. But they all said that was the worst mistake they made because once you stop pedaling,
they got cold.
They got super cold.
Yeah, of course.
So Tyler Farrar was one of them. He was the sprinter on Garmin at that point. And he finished like 10 minutes behind our massive group. And he was the last rider of the whole day. And this is like a guy that was like one of my idols and was kind of like a warrior, you know. He was like a guy that never showed pain. He would get up from a crash and just like, you know, spit in his own wounds and just like rub them out and be like, yeah, you know, here we go, we're good. And then he gets into the car and I was like, I was pretty warm at this point, so I was like helping him take his jackets off because, you know, your hands stop working. And he's like, all right, dude, thanks, man, like, thanks, I'm good now. And he's just sat there and he's just not talked for 2 minutes. And then I've never seen a man cry like this in my life. Like, it was like someone had died in his family.
Well, I have that experience a few times, actually, where I'm so cold that I just started crying.
It's just the most horrible feeling ever. And you're like, anyone else would just pull over and hop in a cafe or a bar or whatever. But you couldn't, man. Yeah, it was like you're in the Giro. You got to get through this thing. So then our director came up to us that afternoon and he was like, all I want to say is I'm really sorry you had to do that. Like, I don't know what else to say. I'm just really sorry. And then he left the room and it was like, even the directors knew how fucked up the day was.
Yeah.
But anytime I've been cold in my life now, I just think back to the Gavia Stelvio stage at the Giro and I'm like, you're cold, man, but you aren't that cold.
Sounds like a horrible day, but also, crazy. Good story, man. What's your favorite race?
That's a hard one. It's a hard one.
I know you love Amstel, but you also love being at home, racing at home.
Yeah, I think, you know, just as a raw race, I think it's really hard to choose between... Like, I've sort of got 4 one-day classics that are just my absolute favorite. And I don't know if it's because I'm good at them or it's because I actually love them. But it's Amstel Gold, Strada Bianchi, and then the Quebec and Montreal races in Canada. They're just, all of them are awesome for their own reasons. Like, Canada, you just feel like a VIP from the second you arrive. And you're riding through some of the most beautiful historic cities and the crowds are great. Amstel is just like a matrix of crazy and super hard short climbs, which has sort of always been my bread and butter as a cyclist. And then Strada is gravel, which is just my other passion.
Yeah.
But I have to say, though, is as a whole, I just love doing Tour Down Under.
Yeah.
The vibe's unreal. You know, we don't really get to connect with Australian cycling very often, you know, where we're in Europe for 10 months of a year. And it's just so nice to go home and feel genuinely the love and the encouragement from all the Australian fans. And and it's just nice to also race through the gum trees of Adelaide Hills and feel like, you know, this is my turf. You know,
it's also super nice organized. Like, it's really, everything is just perfect. You fly there with Singapore Airlines, you fly business class, nice hotel, Hilton in Adelaide, the city of the town, like super good training the days before, and the race is super cool itself.
Yeah, and you stay in one hotel, and most of the stages you ride to the start and ride home. So it just feels like the best way to start a season. And and like a lot of the European riders have really cottoned onto it now. Is like, it's a cool experience if you can handle the heat. But that's the other thing too, is like, we've spent the whole summer getting heat acclimatized and training, and then the Europeans come over and they've just got this massive handicap because they've been in like -4.
I did it once, and I don't think I'm ever going to do it again because I didn't handle the heat very well. But then again,
hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now I'm like, you know, you tend to forget when shit's been bad. And now I'm like, oh, I want to go on this trip again because it's just a cool trip. But the race days we had there, I was suffering like hell. I had heat strokes 3 or 4 days in a row and it was not good. But it was cool to be there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing too is though, like, we're not racing in like Mickey Mouse heat. Like, one of the days was 47 and I also got heat stroke and it fucked me for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Like, I missed the Cadell race. I didn't even, like, I think I started 80Ks of it and I just, as soon as the race even started going fast, it was like, it felt like it was a motorbike in front of me and I got dropped. And it wasn't like I didn't have good form. Like, I went in 1 stages of Oman a week later. It was like I was fit. But once you go deep at 47 degrees, I mean, it doesn't matter if you spent the whole summer doing that. It just fucks you up.
Yeah, it fucks your body. So you had some good times there. You were third overall 1 year, no?
Oh, no,
you lost the podium on the last stage.
We finished on the same time, but it came down to stupid, like, stage placings.
Yeah.
So Jay McCarthy finished 2 places in front of me overall from all the stages combined, which was pretty frustrating, but that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when you're there, you spend after Adelaide, after Tour Down Under, you have 1 week in Geelong for the Cat 11s race. And that's a whole nother contrast to Adelaide, which is just a super nice city. And then you go to Adelaide, which is this small town an hour away from Melbourne. There's nothing there. And you've been away for quite a while. I have. So you really start to get bored there. But
yeah, Geelong's, it's cute, but yeah, once you've been to the two cafes and gone for a swim, you're like, okay, so we're pretty done here.
But we struck gold.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Man, I don't think anyone did the Cadell race.
Everybody
like you and
saw
I
that
did.
On the Instagram page of the podcast. That arcade was the saving of our week there. Like,
oh, man. It's one of the best arcades I've ever been in my life. Like,
I haven't been in anything better. There's one just out here in Seoul, just next to Girona, but it's nowhere near the same.
Yeah, I don't think... But also, like, there's no memories like that. So Mads and I, like, after dinner every night, because, like, we're on Team Katusha, which was a great team, but the team that they sent to Australia that year was just the most dull humans you could have put in a group. It was like...
There was not much action going on.
No, they're the kind of guys that, like, you know, they finish a two-hour ride and they go and hop in their compression boots, close all the blinds to make their room like a dark cave and just sit there and watch boring Netflix until dinner. And then they do the same just after dinner. And at dinner as well, they weren't even talking to each other because that's like, disrespect to them. They're just kind of like introverted, quiet dudes. But Mads and I, after a couple of days, were like, we can't handle this. So we just went for a walk and we're like, hang on, what's this? And we found this arcade. And then the first night we were like, it's good. Oh my God. And then the next night we went back and we bought like a VIP card and loaded the shit out of it with money. And we were like, all right.
Slowly we figured out which machines were the ones to get, like where we got most tickets from our winnings. And the best one was this where you throw balls and knock down clowns. Then we got off this technique. There was two machines, so we took all the balls from both machines and put in one, and we threw like six balls at a time.
Yeah, we even stopped trying to like aim specifically for one clown. Yeah. We just like went for the shotgun effect.
Yeah. Then one day we are staying here at this machine. We go to another one. See, like, okay, there's not that many tickets here. We won't get any big prizes from this. So we go back, and then two girls are at one of them. And we're, like, going, getting ready to do our technique with the balls, but then suddenly there's not many balls. So the girls took some of the balls, and Nathan, in just pure, I don't know if you can call it excitement, but, like, throw a ball, everything he can, and says, bitch is fucked us. And I was like, dude, they heard you.
Yeah.
So two minutes later, we had all the balls again.
Yeah, they kind of left. They're like, oh, God. But yeah, like, I often forget, like, when I'm in Europe, like, I know a lot of people speak English, but, like, it's sort of that thing where, like, you feel like you can say what you want because you're like, oh, 9 times out of 10, you know, no one really paid attention to what I was saying. But then I'm like, hang
like
on,
the
shit.
The Danes have here, like, we can say
yeah, you guys have, like,
a
secret code. But then I'm in Australia and I'm like, hang on, they even speak Australian English. So, like, they even picked up everything I just said. So I felt like a bit of a dick afterwards. But then we got all our balls back and we got some tickets. So I think we found out who the real winner was.
Yeah. In the end, I think I came away with a pair of what they call, like, cozy sandals for a home with an emoji on it and a bit more stupid stuff. But
did we take a basketball as well? I think we got a basketball, but then we never played with it because we suck at ball sports.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, we're cyclists.
Okay. What's the worst race for you then?
I think there's
maybe
two.
It's not that much about the race itself, but everything around it. And
the only race that I always am scared to get put on every season is a race called Nokere Course.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's a crash race.
It's just... So it was the first race I ever did in Europe as a World Tour rider. So, like, I'll just do a little bit of a catch-up on my history as a rider. Like, I was mountain biking, and then I started doing road in Australia, and I did, like, all the Asian races. And I signed World Tour from all of this. And then next thing, I'm in Europe, and I'm like, hang on, I'm in the World Tour, and I've never raced in Europe before. I was like, oh my God, this is really intimidating. And the team's like, oh, we'll put you in one of the small Belgium classics. See how you go.
I did Nokere twice, and I crashed out both times.
I'd never seen anything like it. Like, I felt like it was a scene from, like, D-Day, where they're running up the beaches, and just guys next to you are just, like, getting exploded by a landmine, and then the next guy's getting, like, machine gunned down, and you're like, how am I still up? How am I still up? And then... then we're kind of going towards this final, and there's this horrible little like false flat uphill where I was just like, these guys are going full gas. What's happening? What's happening?
Oh, yeah. And before you go up this drag and then you turn right down to the hole.
Yeah. Like, but before that, there's these two houses that have these like sharp corners that are just facing you as the rider.
Yeah.
And you got to like squeeze into it. It's like a... it's like a salt timer, you know, like it feels like 10 guys can go through, but there's like 400 behind you trying to get in. So anyway, I was just really shit in the bunch at that point. So I was just like stuck at the back and was like, oh no, like, damn, like I can't help the guys. And then I come around the corner, we go down this little downhill, and then I saw what was just like a mincemeat version of the peloton. Like I've never seen so many guys crashing and screaming like, And I look over and this one guy that I knew really well, who'd really helped me out, you know, in my time in Australia, Kunda Court, he's sitting there and like, I was like, he's more blood than he is skin. Like I've never seen anything like this. And like I roll up and like I go around the guys and then I was like, hang on, I just finished like top 40. Like, I was at the back of the race. Yeah. Everyone was down. And every time I've done Nokra course, it's just been exactly the same experience. So yeah. Like I've gotten to the point now where I'm like, oh guys, I'll ride early. Like make sure you've like done your job, because like there is no way on God's green earth I ever want to contest that final, because I just have too much respect for my own skin.
Yeah. Okay. So another one I ask all the guests, who is your nemesis in the world of cycling?
Oh,
we all have them.
We do. And I'm really lucky that he's retired now. He's
then you can
out.
Say whatever you want.
So it's a guy. And I think not many people in the world of cycling actually know who this guy is. He's a bit of a guy that flew under the radar. But he seemed to be always good enough to always be there, but never good enough to really be like a deep finalist.
Yeah.
But it was sort of like, as soon as it was hard, he was always the guy next to me. And it was just like, dude, fuck off, man. Like, stop fighting me for this shit. And he was a Russian called Chachevich.
Ah, yeah. I've heard many, many, many stories about him from my teammates in Katusha. Yeah, from our teammates in Katusha.
So he was on Katusha. And like, I should be careful what I say, because I heard he became, well, even before he retired, guys were asking him, what are you going to do after cycling? He's like, gangster. But like, I don't think he was joking. So like, maybe I should be like, careful. Maybe we should like bleep his name. I should be like, who's your nemesis? Beep.
Yeah.
Chavich. But this guy was insane. And like, it was at Tour Down Under one year. He was next to me and Hejedal. So this was in 2012. Yeah. My first ever world tour race. And he came up and he kind of just like chopped Ryder on this like piece of road that there was no stress. Like yeah. Fair game if you're going to fight in the final, like anything goes in the final. Like there's no honor amongst thieves. We get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you're like 80 Ks out from the finish and the race is just starting to warm up and someone comes in and like almost ends your leader of the race's life, I like yelled over, I was like, man, what the fuck? And then he just lifts his front wheel up and starts smashing it down. And I'm like, bang, 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 bang. And he goes, I will fucking kill you. And from that day onwards, I was like, that guy is my nemesis.
Yes. Boy, that was a good one. Best and worst roommate you ever had?
I'm not being biased because we're on a podcast, but you were definitely one of my favorite roommates. It's like,
oh, we had fun.
There's so few guys that sort of like sit on your same vibration as you. Like, you know, sometimes you're like, dude, will you shut the fuck up and stop talking? And then some other guys, you're like, man, are you alive? Like, what's going on? But yeah, we always had so much fun, man. And like, whether we were racing awesome or whether we were sort of just like coming back from illness or injury or just working for other guys, like we always just had the same vibe in the room. So it was like, it was always just really fun. And we talk shit. We kind of like having music at the right time, but also quiet at the other time. But Hejedal was another guy, and Tyler Farrar. Like, I was on a team with Tyler for 6 years of my career, and it was almost like, as soon as we were at a race together, it was like no one even thought twice. It was just like Tyler and I were in the same room. It was the same as us. We just, we had so much fun that whatever the outcome of the race was, whether it was like we won or we crashed, we just had such a good time. And it's kind of the best medicine for success and for failure in cycling is forgetting about the day and moving to the next. But then, the worst roommate I ever had, Wow, that's a hard one. You know, some guys fart a lot, and that's pretty gross. Some guys...
Oh, I do that too.
Yeah, but like, farting a bit, it's like, okay, we eat a lot of gels. Like, you know, it's going to happen. Yeah, but when some guys...
A few protein drinks also get your stomach going.
But some guys are like, dude, what's happened to you, man? Like, you need to see a doctor. This isn't right. But then, like, for me, the one that really kind of, like, fucks me up is like I'm definitely more of an extrovert. I have my introverted time, but like I'm more of an extrovert.
Yeah.
So when someone literally doesn't talk to you for a week, it's really odd. Like I prefer to be in a room alone. And there was a guy, I started calling him Stracula the Dracula, but his name was Dimitri Strakov.
He didn't speak English.
Don't get me wrong though, super nice guy. Like there was nothing.
He was this guy we got in Katusha. He started as a stashier, and then he got his contract by the year where everything fucked up in Katusha.
But, like, super nice guy. Like, it wasn't like he had a bad vibe or anything, but his English was so bad that he just, you'd be like, good morning. He's like, morning.
Yeah.
And then before he'd go to sleep, he'd go, good night. And that was it. But he'd sit on his phone. So he had, like, a mobile phone that clicked into this like gaming device, and he'd have his headphones in, and he was playing these like super violent war games. But so he was like online with his friends, but on the phone it had these like two little metal like clicker things that like hit your screen. So every time you like the machine gun would go off, I'd literally hear this like tack 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 tack, and then I'd hear him just speaking this like scary Russian like to his friends, and then he'd kill someone, and he would always go yeah. And I felt like I was sleeping with one eye open because I was like, oh my god, this guy showed me all these photos of him in the like Russian military with these like massive guns, and I'm just like, I feel like this guy could just like kill me in my sleep, and I wouldn't even know I was being killed. Like, this is insane. Yeah.
But he was like, he got a stashier contract with the team, and he was actually better in his stashier contract than when he got the actual contract. And it was like, I did the tour of Britain with him.
He was incredible.
Yeah, he was incredible.
Incredible.
And he didn't understand anything. And one day there's a strong break up the road, and we really have to be there. And they have 45 seconds. Tony tried, Polly tried, I tried. We all tried, and then Strakov is sitting there, and all we can say to him, because he didn't even understand go, so we had to tell him to say, davai, davai. And then he just went, boom, and he bridged that gap, and it was strong riders in that breakaway.
No, that guy is an absolute weapon on a bike, and like I said, super nice guy, but just in terms of sitting in a room, oh, it was just an awkward, uncomfortable silence. And then you're hearing...
Okay, so which bike has meant the most to you through time?
Oh, I love my DeRosa now. It's definitely the best disc brake bike I've ever ridden, which for me was like... You know, when disc brakes first came into the Peloton and then we started using them, it was like, oh, I love the braking power, but the bike just doesn't work right.
Yeah.
And then I hopped...
Because it was rim brakes bikes where they just put disc brakes on. So it wasn't made for disc brakes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, I think a lot of the like the torque tolerances through the bike weren't designed for that extra force. And then all of a sudden you've got the, you know, the through axles adding all this extra stiffness on a bike that was designed to have a 9mm quick release. So, you know, technology's come a long way, and I'm really loving my DeRosa now. But I think in terms of any one bike that, like, I'm actually trying to investigate who has it, because I wouldn't mind buying it as just a bit of, like, cycling memorabilia for myself. Was in 2017 on Dimension Data, we were sponsored by Cervelo. And they had just released a prototype of the R5.
Yeah.
And because I was always the guy that wanted to be on the R5, even though they were like, Nathan, you're more of a fast guy. I was like, no, but I prefer the feeling of a bike that feels like a bike. You know, when you're on a bike that's purely aerodynamic, it's
like a classic frame and
just classic. It's just triangles. When you're out of the saddle, it like has that predictable flex and acceleration. And then when you're on a downhill, you feel like you can actually really move it off its line if you're in trouble. Whereas an aero bike, I've always felt once you're on that corner, you're really stuck on your line because it's just a blade.
Yeah.
So they were like, Nathan, you're one of our big riders on the team, and I know you love the bike, so we're going to give you the prototype. And the coolest thing was, I was like testing this prototype in the world tour, but it had this paint job on it with all these like cool little dots and everything that you normally see on cars.
Yeah.
So it's that paint that you put on a car that's also a prototype or new, that if you take a photo of it, it doesn't really give you the real shape, like it distorts the photo.
Mm.
So it was the coolest paint job I ever had on a bike. And it also just felt cool to be on like the prototype from a company as cool as Cervelo.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the bike that I was second on Wollonga on, and I was fourth at Amstel on it. So like, I've got a lot of good memories from that bike, and you know, it got sold at the end of the season. And if there's a listener in Denmark that happens to have my 2017 Cervelo R5 special paint, let's talk.
Yeah. You can earn big bucks on that. But yeah, let's talk a bit more about bikes, because now the bikes and all the equipment in modern cycling, that's the game changer. Like, if you're behind on equipment, you have no chance. You can look at the TTs like this, like let's say 10 years ago, if you did a bike fit, proper bike fit on the TT bike, you would be going for the win. If you don't do it now, you're going to struggle with the time limit.
Yeah, it's that extreme. It's a space race, man. It's whichever companies have the most money to be able to invest produce the fastest bikes. And it's not that the smaller companies aren't trying, it's just when you have a company, say like Specialized, that have their own ability to make the carbon molds in their factories, and then they have their own wind tunnels, you know, it's all of those costs for a smaller bike manufacturer that are just on top. So they can make maybe 3 or 4 prototypes with, you know, a few changes each time. But then all of a sudden they're at $5 million and they're like, shit, that's insane. But with the big companies that have already invested actually in the process, like the manufacturing process, it doesn't cost them $5 million because they already have the staff, they have the engineers, they're not hiring them out. And then they have the facilities to keep testing it and testing it and testing it. So when they finally release a bike, it's like, it's the state of the art. So every time a small company puts something out, it's catching up, but the other company's already jumped ahead because they're testing it. But then the other thing that I'm finding the most frustrating, and, you know, maybe this is a bit of a contentious topic, but, you know, when a team can put $20,000 for a rider to get a custom handlebar made and have them on all 4 of their TT bikes, it's not really fair. And I think that that's something that the UCI hasn't like really looked into. They're like, oh yeah, it follows the rule of like, it's not further than 10 mils from the bars to the top and this and that. But it's basically, it's created a class system within cycling. And I don't think that really shows the true values of sport about fairness, because it's
You can see it in our team, for example. Like some of us, we have these special designed bars on the TT bike, and I have it, so I love it. But I also think that everybody should have it, because also one day we all in a TTT, in a team time trial.
Correct.
So everybody should have the fastest possible equipment, in my opinion.
I agree. And it's sort of one of those things that, like, you know, Formula One, even though there's huge discrepancy between cars, you know, they all have to use the same tires.
Mm.
There's engine restrictions that everyone has to follow.
Yeah, because in cycling, it comes down to everything now. It's the tires, it's the frame, it's the wheels, it's the clothing, it's the helmet, it's even down to the socks. Like if you're riding aero socks or normal socks, there's maybe 1 or 2 watts in there, but sometimes that's the difference.
But also the other difference is teams being able to afford not just one, but as many sessions in the wind tunnel as they want. You know, a team can put a rider in the wind tunnel for a day and it costs thousands. Such an expensive process, and they start to get the big things like the overall position. They start moving the bars, or maybe they even test 2 different types of bars and say, okay, this one's actually better in this position. But other teams are now starting to work out, okay, Nick's for this person only need to go in the mid thigh, but for this person all the way down to the knees faster. And then they start saying, put your thumb on top or put your thumb underneath.
Yeah.
And that can only happen on like the 4th or 5th time you're in the wind tunnel, where you start dotting the I's and crossing the T's, whereas other people are first learning the ABC. Yeah. And that's even if they have the money to send them to a wind tunnel. And then let alone, like, you have these really nice fast handlebars, but they're still commercial. They're still something that you can buy. Whereas other people are literally having their body put into a position and then a 3D printed bar fits into them.
Yeah.
So how do I compete against Gunnar, who is already infinitely more talented and powerful than I am? But then he also has equipment that I have no access to. Even if I pay for it, I can't use it.
Yeah.
So it's just one of these things where I'm finding time trials, or the discipline of time trial, which is something I really enjoy doing. It's like a side project. I'm not a specialist, but I've always enjoyed it. It's just one of these things that I look at now and I just think, well, you know, that's not been the direction of my career. So I have to just absolutely forget about it. And I think when we look at like the Tour de France, when you have GC, we want to see an exciting GC race. And one of the things that's putting guys 1 or 2 or even 3 minutes in the rear just because of their equipment, and it's got nothing to do with their ability.
Yeah.
For me, we're starting to lose a little bit of the integrity of the sport.
Yeah. 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 That's right. And yeah, it's even the clothing. Some teams, they make their own clothing and they make everything exactly for each rider. Where some other teams, they have shit clothing that's like a t-shirt in the wind. And then it's just like riding into a wall all the time. Because you can't go 55K an hour on the flats. It's really developing in a also a super interesting way with all this equipment. But it's just, you have to be so accurate on everything now.
Yeah, and I don't say this to sort of like bitch on the teams that are making use of their budget. Like, I would.
Yeah, of course.
And if I was on one of those teams, I'd be thinking like, how good is this? Yeah. I'm beating guys that are better than me. But at the same time, it just sort of goes, that's the cycling model, right? Like, some teams have more money.
Yeah.
And that's just something that we have to also accept. And, you know, cycling's also already a sport that the strongest rider doesn't win. It comes down to tactics. It comes down to instinct. It comes down to timing. It comes down to luck. So, you know, it's sort of an inherent part of cycling, is that fairness is not the one thing. It's not just putting on a pair of runners and running 100 meters and the best athlete wins. There's so many factors to it. But definitely I felt like in the last 5 years, time trialing has gone from like, yeah, we're all on pretty similar equipment. Like, someone has something a bit faster, but now it's just a space race that, yeah, you know, if you didn't get to the moon first, yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Okay. We're running out of time, actually. So let's finish off with this last question here. What do you look forward to the most when the season is over?
Oh, when I was young, it was just beers and partying.
Yeah. Any special food you look forward to just greasing your way through? Or
again, it used to be junk food and shit. Like, yeah. But as I've sort of gotten older and realized that, like, your body needs more love, like, it, there's like an inflection point. I reckon it's about 24. Before that, it's like you can put anything into your body and you generally feel fine. You know, your body recovers and you bounce and you start your first race. You're like, yeah, off season is the best thing to do. Then there's a point where you're like, whoa, that doesn't work anymore. And yeah, then my off seasons now are like, wow, how many days can I actually spend at home? Like, how can I go to bed at 10 o'clock and just watch a good movie and like have good home cooked food? Cause you know, we eat so many buffets through the year. And
yeah,
but I think for me, it's about going home to Australia and having my mum's home-cooked food. I think that's always the thing I look forward to the most.
Yeah.
I sound a bit boring now, and don't get me wrong, I used to love having all the fun in the world, but there's a point where your reward is actually the rest and looking after yourself, and that feels better.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for joining my podcast. I really enjoyed this, and it was a nice talk. It was a nice podcast, I think.
Yeah, thanks, man. And let's hopefully put some sun cream on your next ride.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck, it's going to hurt. Cool. See you, Nathan. Thank you.
Lige her på falderevet vil jeg sige tak for, at du har lyttet med. I den næste episode snakker jeg med briten Alex Dowsett, som jeg kører på hold med lige nu. Alex er lidt af en enkeltstartsnørd, så vi kommer helt sikkert til at snakke rigtig meget om enkeltstarter og udstyr i næste episode. Vi optager episoden dagen inden vi starter Romandiet Rundt, så jeg vil udgive min snak med Alex, inden Romandiet Rundt er slut. Endnu en gang tak, fordi du lyttede med. Vi lyttes ved.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.